you're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. And it lies between the pit of one's fears and the summit of one's knowledge. You are now traveling through a dimension of imagination. You just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Anthology, presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. I'm your host, Matt Hurt, and if this is your first time listening, Anthology is one man's examination of the Twilight Zone as a first-time viewer. Each podcast, I share my first impressions, analysis, and overall thoughts on Rod Serling's iconic series one episode at a time. However, in this bonus episode review series, I'm reviewing Season 2 of Jordan Peele and Simon Kinberg's Twilight Zone reboot on CBS All Access, hosted by Jordan Peele. You can find more of Anthology as well as full episode archives at anthologypod.com. And if you want to contact me, you can use the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod, tweet me at @OVAnthologyPod, or send an email to matt@obsessiveviewer.com. Finally, if you want to support the show and get access to exclusive content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and pledge a minimum of $1 per month for an exclusive RSS feed with content recorded specifically for Patreon supporters. Today on the show, I'll be discussing You Might Also Like. It's the 10th and final episode of The Twilight Zone's second season, and it premiered on June 25th, 2020 on CBS All Access. So I'm going to be reviewing that, but first I do have a couple of things I want to hit before I get to the review. First is that if you listened to my Meet in the Middle review, you'll know that I talked about Emily Chang writing and starring in a movie called Grass that sounded like an indie comedy drama. That movie is available to stream on Netflix. I haven't watched it yet, but it is available to stream. Again, that's called Grass, and it features Emily Chang, who co-wrote Meet in the Middle. And then the only other thing that I have to bring up is just to tell you guys to check out Tom Elliott's interview with Wynn Rosenfeld, executive producer of The Twilight Zone and writer for The Who of You. This episode, Tom Elliott's episode of his just out of this world, insanely good, The Twilight Zone podcast, went up the day before the season premiered. So there's no spoilers for the season. It's just a really good chat between Tom Elliott and executive producer Wynn Rosenfeld. So go ahead and check that out. I highly recommend it. I'll put a link in the show notes, of course. All right, and that's all of the preamble I have. Let's just dive right into You Might Also Like. So I am going to be spoiling the entire episode from the jump. So if you haven't seen You Might Also Like, go back and watch it on CBS All Access, and then come back and listen to my review. So you have been sufficiently warned. Yeah. All right. Spoilers on for You Might Also Like. So the plot summary, courtesy of CBS All Access, is stay-at-home housewife Mrs. Warren looks forward to acquiring the widely marketed egg, an enigmatic device that promises to make everything better for everyone forever. But further investigation soon reveals the unsavory truth about this mysterious product. So, You Might Also Like stars Gretchen Mol as Janet Warren. She is known for her work, she's done a lot of work. I know her primarily from her work on Boardwalk Empire on HBO. And then she was also in the film Manchester by the Sea, which is a phenomenal movie. And then co-starring in this episode is Greta Lee as Ellen Jones. She was in Russian Doll on Netflix and High Maintenance on HBO, I believe. This is the first thing I've seen Greta Lee in, and, I'll talk about her performance in this episode. Writer and director for this episode is Osgood Perkins. Oz Perkins previously directed Gretel and Hansel, which came out earlier this year when movie theaters still existed. And then in 2016, he directed I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, which again is available on Netflix. And then he also directed The Black Coat's Daughter. And as a writer, he wrote those things, except for Gretel and Hansel. And then he also wrote a movie called The Girl in the Photographs. Something that kind of blew my mind today when I was putting together my notes for this recording is that Oz Perkins is the son of Anthony Perkins. That blew my mind. Anthony Perkins, of course, played Norman Bates in Psycho. And it's funny because in my review for Meet in the Middle, I reference Psycho and I reference Anthony Perkins in particular. But anyway, Oz Perkins is the son of Anthony Perkins, and he also played young Norman Bates in 1983's Psycho 2. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And he previously teased this episode of The Twilight Zone. He had talked about it in an interview somewhere. I'll dig it up and put it in the show notes. But he had talked about how this is an out of this world episode, and how he couldn't believe that he was allowed to do the things that he did in this episode. So I went in with that knowledge, and it still kind of exceeded my expectations of weirdness. So I'll get to that in a bit. So my initial thoughts on You Might Also Like, this is what I wrote up when I watched it for the first time. So, oh man, what a trippy and crazy episode. The Canimates return, and I'm so happy that I saw To Serve Man in the 60th anniversary theater screening, because otherwise I would have felt a little bit out of my element in terms of just, I would have felt disconnected from it, having not seen To Serve Man. So I just think that this episode just has a ton of balls, confidence. I don't know if it's so for context, I'm recording this on June 24th. The season is about to launch here in about 6 hours. And today, news broke, like CBS sent out press material for this episode, saying, like, celebrating it as the return of the Canimates. And a lot of news outlets have referred to it as the sequel to Serve Man, which I don't think is the case. Like, it's a little bit messier than that, but I kind of see it as a spiritual successor, or I don't want to say remake, because it's obviously not a remake, but I think that it's a different take on this monster and how they interact with humans. And I could not wait to get to pick this apart and review it and everything. I thought the imagery was incredibly striking, and overall I thought this was an amazing episode. And yeah, so those were my initial thoughts. I've since seen this episode several times and listened to the audio of it and everything. So let me go into my review of You Might Also Like. So this episode is set up uniquely. There are interstitials that include TV commercials, essentially. And then each section of the episode is a chapter, or it's segmented into parts. So I'm going to kind of go part by part and share my thoughts on this episode. So first off, this prologue is our first introduction to the episode. It's a TV commercial of a little girl walking in a forest with a baby doll that she's carrying. And first of all, this introduction to the episode and the way it's segmented in certain ways reminded me a lot of the interstitials in Six Degrees of Freedom from last year, which was one of my favorite episodes of last season. So already off to a pretty good start. So the initial commercial is a little girl walking in the forest, and it's teasing, the voiceover is teasing the egg. It's this mysterious product that is supposed to be, you know, help the world and help you, and it's the only thing you'll ever need. And then it switches to a VR headset commercial, and there are VR sex goggles, and it has this really ridiculous voiceover narration where it's your husband saw a baby come out of that, and now he needs something to distract him, or something like that. And what's interesting is that this, my kind of take on this whole episode is that these commercials are implanted by the Canimates, and I hope I'm pronouncing that right, by the way, and using the correct wording. But anyway, they're produced by the Canimates, and it's for brainwashing purposes. So everyone's commercial is different. Maybe she's the only one that gets the commercials in her head because she's the only dissenting human being in the episode and everything, who's questioning the reality. So the VR sex goggles are an extension of her. I feel like it's likely a commentary on, not a commentary, but it's indicative of her feeling of self-worth after the stillborn incident a couple of years ago. This episode's going to be interesting to review. But I do want to mention that the VR sex goggles, it's called Eye Wide Shut, intimacy goggles. And that's another Stanley Kubrick reference. So after the intimacy goggles shot, we get a shot of the registration for fulfillment card and the voiceover just explaining kind of the exposition of it, saying that, you know, you want the egg, you need to come to the fulfillment center at the allotted time and get your egg for your family so that everything will be okay and everything will be okay forever or whatever. But I want to point out that the shot of the registration for fulfillment card has the address of 12345 Maple Street, Anytown, USA. So obviously that's a reference to The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. And also, if you look by the date in the middle of the card, they have a kind of stamp on the other side that is impressed into the card that is the Kanemet language letters. So that's interesting. So after those commercials, Janet wakes up in bed and she's disappointed and disoriented. She says, like, God damn it. And she looks over and sees the picture of her husband, who's played by Gil Bellows, which will come in later because he has one scene after this. It's just kind of showing that the commercials are subliminal. It's about to show that commercials are subliminal. I'll get to that in a minute. So, there's a kind of a, not montage, but there's a series of scenes, so technically a montage, where Janet is sniffing around for the cause of her passing out. She's smelling the smoke detector. She's kind of just going around and, sniffing and seeing if she can detect some kind of leak or something. And we get a really good view of just the idyllic house that she lives in. It's a very picturesque. Everything is so perfectly in frame and perfectly, just perfect, except for the son's room. But everything else is just pristine and perfectly clean and everything. So that's a good indicator of it being kind of a warped world a little bit, because it's just too picturesque. It's too perfect. And then there's a shot of her smelling the oven, like looking for the leak. And I thought that was an interesting, visual, like some interesting imagery, because I equate it to, you know, the kind of, method of suicide of sticking your head in the oven. And I don't know if that's intentional in this episode or not, but I felt like it was, pretty symbolic of her kind of lack of will to live to an extent, or her, I don't know if I would even go that far, but it kind of seems like it's a symbol of her lack of will to live. So yeah, I will go that far. So then the doorbell rings and it's her neighbor, Mrs. Jones, Ellen Jones, played by Greta Lee. And, she's like Janet is just explaining what's going on, saying that she's, fainting regularly. It happens a lot. And there's a shot of her in the dining room that just looks gorgeous. Like, she is perfectly center. Above, there are three light fixtures that are, like, she's directly under the middle one. And then the neighbor is kind of at the end of the counter. And it's just like the symmetry of it and the way that everything is just white. Like, even their clothes are just white. It's just like overbearingly, bright and vibrant. And it's kind of really in contrast to her, confused and unhappy nature that we'll get to later. And then the friend is kind of this, how can I put this? Ellen is kind of a dick. She's a smartass. Like, she doesn't really seem to care about Janet's situation. Instead, she just kind of says, I used to think your kitchen gets better light than mine, but I don't anymore. And then she makes a jab at the countertops, saying, you chose these? I don't know. I thought that was really funny. The way that Greta Lee plays that character is very, very good. I really enjoyed her performance there. So Janet goes on to say that she hears music, short sequences of chords, and then feels a lightness and a whooshing. And I was wondering, is she hearing the Twilight Zone theme music? Is that what that's supposed to signify? Because I didn't really catch that. I think that was my assumption the first viewing, but it doesn't really hold water or anything. But they're talking, and Janet does mention that if I could strike a match and burn it to the ground, I would, and get a fresh start. And first of all, kind of relatable. I get that. And it's kind of shows that Janet is someone who can't really be content with her life of just having everything. And that's when the kind of egg comes into play. So the egg is this mysterious piece of merchandise that everyone is wanting and everyone needs to have. The advertisements are saying that it's the last thing you'll ever need. It's something for your family. Just all of these platitudes about how important this egg is. And Janet is the only one who can see that it's like, it doesn't make sense. There's not enough information to have this spell cast upon, people. So, Ellen's allotted fulfillment hour, is 1 p.m. that day, and Janet tells her that hers is at 4. And it's just, again, it kind of goes into this whole, like, oh, everything is all about the egg. Because Ellen is just like, how can you wait that long? I don't know how you can wait that long. But then everything stops because Janet starts to feel the sensation that she's about to pass out again. So she's walking through the dining area and into the kind of living room or study or whatever. And she is saying that she's hearing it and she's asking if Ellen can hear it and everything. And then she freezes. She lifts her hand up and points to the ceiling and then looks up at the ceiling and then she's almost frozen in place. And then that's when the camera moves over to the wall where the family portrait is. And there's Jordan Peele and we have our opening narration. So here is a clip from the episode of Jordan Peele's opening narration.
Hold on. I think it might.
Submitted for your approval, Mrs. Janet Warren. A woman who would seem to have everything. Every thing. But possessions have weight. We can't carry them all at the same time. Especially when taking an unscheduled trip into the Twilight Zone.
So about this opening narration, first of all, I love that he says submitted for your approval. That is fantastic. And, I love it. I love the energy that Jordan Peele is bringing to these opening narrations this season. I really do. Like when he says everything and he says everything, it's just, it has this air of, I don't know if I'd say power behind it, but it has this just kind of smirk in the words, I would say. And then at the end of it, it's something weird that I didn't quite understand, but Peele lifts up his hand the same way that Janet was doing to the ceiling before the narration. And then there's a pause, a music hit, and then he moves his hand. Or I don't even think he really moves his hand. It just slowly moves it and the lights go down. And then we get the opening credits and everything. So, it's a little weird. It doesn't really have any payoff. I don't understand what that necessarily is. But it's not really needed to have any kind of explanation or anything. It's just something cool that happened in the episode. So after the opening credits, we get our next kind of interlude of commercials. And here we see a family eating breakfast. And I thought this was really interesting because it's Gil Bellows as the father, who, as we said before in the prologue, we see his picture by the bed when Janet wakes up. So Gil Bellows is the father of that family. And he is Mr. Warren. So in this commercial, we see him at the breakfast table with his family and his two sons and his wife, who is not Janet. I'm like 99% sure that there's no way that that's Gretchen Mol. So I thought that was interesting. And at first I didn't catch it. I didn't understand. Like I thought it was just another family. And I thought that the house, cause it's clearly like the same house, but I thought that what they were saying was that each house is the exact same and that this is like an exact replica or something, but it's not. This is the Kanemitz reaction to Janet wanting to burn the house to the ground. They're implanting her with the immolation station commercial and putting her family in that situation. So like the kid, her son says, "Dad, what's immolation? I'm going to have so much fun saying that word." And he says, "You remember Don Perkins? Well, Perkins. Huh, interesting. Anyway, you remember Don Perkins? Well, instead of having a garage sale, he lit a match and burned his house down. Burned everything and everyone to the ground. A fresh start." And then that leads into the actual commercial for the immolation station. The announcer says, come on over to the immolation station to play with matches and watch it all burn. So my kind of theory at this point is that the Kanemits are altering the commercials based on Janet's mood and growing awareness of how bizarre everything is. Like, they're trying to get her to invest in this egg idea and everything. But I want to say that this commercial has a bit of darkness to it, because the mother, who I'm still not sure that, I don't think that that's Gretchen Mol, it's another actress, but she's looking at the empty high chair in the commercial. And that is just, it's seeding her grief. That's going to run throughout the episode. But man, that's just, it's hard. It's heartbreaking. But I'll get more into that later. So then after that, we get another commercial for the egg. And this time the girl opens the chest, in the woods and sees just this ugly rock. It kind of reminded me of the giant rock thing in, Parasite, just a little bit. And, yeah. So then we get part one. It's ugly. 11:30 a.m. So Janet and, Ellen, I think is her name, Ellen, they wake up in the bed. They're just laying on their backs with their shoes on and everything. And they wake up, and the neighbor is just, she's super weird. And I love the energy that Greta Lee brings to this performance. She just like sits up and she's like, what happened? Is this happening? Is this what's happening? And like, even when, Janet asks her if she heard the music, her like response to that is to completely ignore that and comment on how brave the pattern is in the bedroom. And then we see Janet move a twig from her hair. And that's when she tells Ellen that she saw the egg and that it's ugly. And, Ellen says, like, Ellen doubts that very much, because she goes on this whole diatribe about how it's to be the centerpiece of every American home, and they wouldn't do that and make it ugly. And it's just really interesting that this episode takes on a tone upon it where Janet is the only one that's aware of what's going on. Like, the weirdness of the Twilight Zone is inhabiting her suburb or her area, her city, and the world even. But she's the only one that's aware of it, or like has that self-awareness. And I think it's maybe possibly because of the grief, because she has pain in her life, and it's an empty void in her life that she hasn't gotten over the death of her daughter. So she's not complacent with just material things, and she's not, I don't know. It's a tough one. This is a really, interesting episode, and I'll talk more about the themes and everything in, toward the end of the episode, but it's just an interesting kind of dynamic at play here, because on the surface, she should be accepting of anything that would be, that would heal her. But, and that's where she kind of ends up with the egg and everything. But it's the journey she goes through to kind of come to that realization. And it's kind of hard to reconcile that realization, her choice at the end, with, the depiction of grief that she goes through and everything. So I don't know. I'll talk more about that later. But, she tries to get the neighbor kind of invested in it. She kind of alludes that it's their problem, that they're having the same problems. And she's slowly getting frantic and everything. Like, she's like trying, she grabs Ellen and tries to pull her toward her and everything. And it's really just fascinating because, Greta Lee, she's great. While she's being pulled by, Janet on the bed, she says, like, with a laugh, she says, are you touching me? It's just so bizarre, so out of left field, so weird. Like, the tone is so, inconsistent with the scene, like, intentionally so, that it's just so bizarre, and it really helps to paint the picture that this world is so freaking weird, and that we're in for a very weird episode. And then it doubles down on that when she says, ow, you're hurting me, but with like this grin on her face. It's just really, really interesting. Like, I love how weird this reality is. And so as Ellen is trying to get away, she says very quickly, she says, I just want to be at my fulfillment center at my fulfillment hour to collect my family's egg like a normal person. And then she runs out and yells, we don't have the same problems. And that's when Janet kind of notices dirt on her shoe. And that's when we get the next part of the story. Part 2, Real Human Being, 12:15 p.m. So the title of this part of the episode, just this is inconsequential and everything, but it makes me think of the song from the movie Drive by College and Electric Youth called A Real Hero. Part of the lyrics are A Real Human Being. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So the first thing we see is Janet at the medicine cabinet. And inside the medicine cabinet is just filled with bottles of medicine. And my initial thought was like, okay, so everyone is in kind of a heavily medicated utopia. And the bottles, though, are labeled just for the conditions. So it's blood pressure. I paused the episode and looked at each bottle. So the bottles include one for blood pressure, moderate pain, cholesterol, libido, thyroid, hunger, infection, happiness, ulcers, alertness, and facial cleansers. And it kind of shows how kind of streamlined this, like, utopic vision is, this utopic reality. Like, any problem can be fixed with just a pill. And it's just very streamlined that way. So she picks up the happiness bottle as she calls her husband's office and asks if he's available. The receptionist or the assistant or whoever is named Megan, and she says that Mr. Warren is in a meeting. He's not available. And then, before I get to the conversation, I thought it was interesting that her husband and her two children are nowhere in this episode except for that one scene in the commercial that is implanted into her mind. It's not to say that obviously it's not like some, there's no theories to mine from that or anything, because it's the middle of the day, she's a stay-at-home mom, and it's just, it's not, there's no mystery surrounding that. But I just think it's interesting that they don't show up at all in the entire episode. And I kind of had this theory that she's in a people are like all over style zoo that the Kanamits put her in, and that she is, my thinking is that this whole reality that she is in, like this world that she's in, is a fantasy that is put on by the Kanamits so that they can effectively eradicate the human race by giving them these visions of this reality, of this utopic, like, suburban life, and then extrapolating upon that a desire for this mystical, mysterious product that's going to solve every problem that they've ever had. So they're all brainwashed and everything, but the entire point of the episode is that she is the only one who breaks that brainwashing, that thing. That's my read of it. It's a pretty out there theory, because it's basically positing that the entire world we see is just as new to her as it is to us. So it's pretty likely that that's not the case, but that's kind of one of my reads of it. But I will say that I love the way that Gretchen Mol plays this role of this housewife who is slowly having this kind of awakening to the world around her being not as it should be and not as it seems. Like, everything, like, she has this self-awareness that carries her, propels her through the story, and Gretchen Mol plays into that so well. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Jennifer Goodwin's performance in Point of Origin last season, but this is different because it's more inquisitive, or it's more introspective on Gretchen Mol's part. And it's played really well. So when she's on the phone with Megan and she asks if her husband's there, she says he's in a meeting. But like, the interchange that happens when Megan asks her if she wants Megan to leave a message for Mr. Warren, Gretchen Mol plays this, like, her line read of this is just amazing. She says, "Honestly, Megan, I can't imagine." And she's so distracted by the pill bottles and everything. It's just like she's, again, she's becoming self-aware. She's becoming aware of the bizarreness of the world. And it carries this distracted awareness that she's realizing that she's up against something that's much bigger than herself. But it's this nonchalantness that she has, or if that's a word, nonchalant nature, that she brings to the lines. That's just really, really remarkable. I really like Gretchen Mol in this episode. And then Megan says something that struck me as very interesting and leading credence to my theory that this whole world is like built around making Janet and the people around her serve themselves up, no pun intended, to the Candidates for, you know, eradication. Because Megan says that Mr. Warren wanted me to remind you that your allotted time of fulfillment is 4 p.m. And this just shows that the Candidates have complete control over everything. And it's just, it's goes so much further in the scenes to come. So I'll save that for then. But this is just a really interesting interchange in the episode. And it leads to Janet having more of an existential conversation with Megan on the phone. And it's just very conversational. She's like, why do you want your family's egg? And I love this as kind of a swipe at consumerism and capitalism and everything, because Megan's response is, because it's coming out. And like that line alone, I love it, because that is so, again, it's a swipe at kind of our consumer culture. And then she follows it up and says, and I want everything to be okay. And so Janet kind of presses her on that and asks, like, well, are you okay? Is your life okay? And like, I just love the kind of casualness of this. So Megan says, things with me are cool. And then she mentions that she wants everything to be okay in the world, the world outside of everything. And she says, have you seen what all these human beings are doing? So again, I think that this is a zoo-like environment from people are like all over, or it's this complete existence, this matrix-like existence that's constructed just for humanity to wipe themselves out through this, magical, egg product. So, yeah, I just feel like that's, I love the idea that this is a kind of riff on the Matrix to an extent. Because Janet is like an anomaly in this world, and the Candidates have orchestrated this world to destroy the human race. And this one outlier is the one that is not wanting the product that they are brainwashing everyone into wanting and needing. So it's just a very interesting riff on that type of story, I think. And that kind of matrix theory leads pretty well into the kind of nihilistic ending that we get, but I'll get to that later. And that really just makes me wonder if the Candidates completely changed reality for everyone, or if this is all just a construct for Janet. It's really hard to tell. I think it's pretty open-ended in that regard. So then Janet calls customer service in order to cancel her egg. Really, at first, she just wants more information. And it's pretty funny. Like, Gretchen Mol does a really great job of selling this self-aware, in a heightened reality character. She's kind of the straight man of this world that's been just thrust upon us, the viewer, and maybe her too, if you subscribe to the idea that this is all a construct for her from the Candidates. So as she's on the phone waiting to get connected to an actual representative, she hears a car screech their tires and everything. And it's her neighbor, who I couldn't catch the name. I think it's Marge Stevens or Marsh Stevens. But she comes home with her egg. She's like delirious and she runs into the house and everything. But something I thought was interesting is that I thought it was weird that Janet stops just short of standing on Marge's lawn. And I don't quite understand the significance of that, because her neighbor Ellen did come over. Maybe it adds even more credence to the idea that she's trapped in this world that's been constructed for her by the Candidates. But I don't know. That's a little too open-ended for me. So Janet eventually kind of turns away and gets on the line with Megan in customer service, which I love that. Like, it's so creepy. Like, the customer service line says that she's Megan, and it's because, my read of that is because her name is Megan because the Candidates are monitoring Janet so closely. So her kind of, well, really, in all, it's one connected brain, so if everything around Janet is Canemit, then she has, that's the reason why, you know, Megan recurs, because that's just the only name that they can have, for someone on the line. I don't know. So anyway, she mentions her address. I just want to shout out this, that her address is 13182 Teacup Road. 13182, I don't know if this is the number or anything, or if it's any significance, but Teacup Road is actually a reference to Oz Perkins's, I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. The titular house, was on Teacup Road or Teacup Lane or something. So that's an interesting kind of connection there. So, Janet wants to cancel, and quote-unquote Megan doesn't understand what she means. And so she says, I just changed my mind. And this line where the customer service rep says, and what is the reason for the change in your mind? It's so creepy and so well done. It's just, it's really great. It just heightens, like, the escalation of this reality that we're in. We're introduced to this kind of utopic reality, and then immediately it's just goes into Bonkersville, and that escalation from there is just so satisfying. Everything escalates that weirdness in the episode. So she says she doesn't want the egg anymore, and then she gets hung up on, which just really, that is where I really kind of hooked into the episode. I was much more invested in the episode at that point. And so she sees that there's dirt on her windowsill that matches the dirt on her shoes. And, that kind of comes into play later. But, after that, there's this very cool shot of her standing outside the door to the nursery. It's shot from, like, at the end of a long hallway, and she is at the end of the hallway, perfectly in frame with the door. And it's just, it feels so cold and isolated. I thought just the imagery of that was really cool. And this is where we get our first real look into her backstory of her having a stillborn child 2 years ago. It's a heavy backstory, and, like, her grief is the kind of driving force of the story and everything. And if I were to lay a criticism against this episode, I feel like it's not really developed as cleanly as the bizarreness of the world is and the bizarreness of the reality is. Like, if we had something that showed, like, okay, well, she had this traumatic thing happen, and that's why she's kind of morose throughout the episode or questioning reality, because she can't have, like, a simple product is not going to fix her entire life. Maybe it would be a little bit better, but here it's just kind of, they lay it on us pretty quickly and everything, and they don't even really lay it on us until later when she's on the spaceship. But then also it makes me wonder if her grief makes her immune to the infiltration from the Canemits. There's a lot that's thrown at us on the ship, so that's something that I just kind of considered at this point. So she's looking around the nursery, and she hones in on the baby monitor on the counter, she takes it out, sets it up in her room and everything so that she can record herself to get more answers about the bizarre things that are happening. And one of the coolest things about this is that the actual product of the baby monitor is a replica of the HAL 9000 from 2001 A Space Odyssey, which is another Stanley Kubrick reference. And I just love it. 2001 is one of my favorite movies of all time. And, like, when I saw this, I have in my notes, I want one. And I don't even have a baby. I just want one. Cause it just looks really cool. So she waits for the music to take her away and everything. And then we don't, like, it doesn't come. So then we cut to her in the kitchen drinking what I think is warm milk or just milk. I'm not sure. And the music starts to play as she looks up. And, what I did notice here is that the music in this episode has been pretty considerably downplayed considering the other two episodes that I've reviewed. It fits the story and it fits the narrative given just the complete craziness of the world that we're in this episode. It doesn't need that extra oomph of a score to kind of lead us down the road of weirdness, because everything else is weird to the 11th degree. So then we get another interlude of a commercial, And this time, Janet is in the commercial, and she's in her kitchen, and she's crying. And the voiceover announcer says, "You've suffered some tough losses, and no one blames you for crying in the kitchen in the middle of the day. You're heartbroken, but you know how to choose your paper towels." And man, just that comes across as the most manipulative part of this entire episode. And like that becomes so manipulative on the Kennemuth's part. It's very interesting that this just turns out to be somewhat of a misunderstanding. Like the Kennemuth, they want Janet to be compliant. They want her to go along with this egg thing so that she doesn't start like an uprising or anything or cause any problems with their goal of just destroying the human race. But they don't understand humans, and that lack of understanding of humans means that they're afraid of humans, because humans have their own individual thoughts, and that's what they fear and everything. So Janet wakes up and sees the footage of her being abducted, and whew. Okay. So the blue nighttime glow in the room is like super creepy, but the dragging effect where she's being kind of pulled by an invisible force across the floor is just super creepy. And like the music in this is very subtle and effective. All of it's just super creepy. It kind of evoked, memories of, Paranormal Activity, and just it's to great effect. I thought it was really well done and very creepy. So now the episode kind of kicks into high gear with part three, The Mad Woman in the Oxygen Tower, 1:33 p.m. So first of all, I love the title of this section, and I love the reveal of this section. But first we have to get through kind of a slowdown of a scene. So she calls this kind of kooky psychic lady. This I thought was kind of peculiar. Like it's a weird contrast to the neighbor lady earlier in the episode, but it's so out there, and it's just so out of left field. And like she doesn't recur in the episode at all. She doesn't come back. There's nothing to follow up on this. It's just a very weird, interaction that Janet goes into with this phone call to her. Like she just needs spiritual guidance and everything, which fine, that's fine. But it's so weird. And it kind of seems a little anachronistic to Janet's, character so far. So, but it's a brief scene, so it doesn't really play much into the episode itself, but it does lead her to finding the tether ball thing. And before that, there's this really cool shot of her wandering around, the yard, leading her to the shed. And what's cool about it is that it's shot from inside the shed. And as she gets closer, that's when the camera kind of pulls back. And the doorway kind of enters the frame in a unique way. Like we don't know that we're in the shed, but as it pulls back, the doorway enters the frame. I thought it was pretty cool. So the kooky psychic lady or whatever says, "Untether yourself, resist gravity, and fly away." And that's when she finds the tether ball. And really, it's not a bad plan. I love the line where she says, "Let's see you beam me up now, Scotty, or whoever you are." So she takes the ball and she ties it to the leg of a chair in her bedroom, and she ties the other end to her ankle. She has a little carabiner thing to keep it in place. And then it's just rapid fire. We get a transition tonight, and she's abducted. Like she's floating out of the room and out of the window. And what I thought was interesting is that it transitions to night. And it made me wonder, like, are the Kennemuths moving her in time too? And like, why are they putting her back? Like, I don't understand how that works and everything in the confines of the episode. But regardless of how it works, it's very creepy imagery and it works pretty well for me. So then we get the outside scene. We see the spaceship and everything. She's in a tree. And then we see the Kennemuths. There are three Kennemuths talking. And oh man, this was such a fun reveal. Like I'm so glad that I went to the 60th anniversary screening back in November. I'm so happy for that, because I've seen To Serve Man now. So I had that context. Obviously I would have caught on and everything, because the Kennemuths are iconic characters from the Twilight Zone, but seeing them here after having seen the episode that they're in back in November was just so fantastic. Just such a cool reveal. I was floored by it. And I also saw it before, CBS kind of, let the cat out of the bag and started, like, sending the promotional stuff to press saying that, the Kennemits are back. So I was so in the dark with it and very surprised. And so they start talking, they kind of all talk at once, and then they have to stop and talk amongst themselves. And really, since it's just one mind, they're all talking, they're saying the same thing, or it's all of one mind. So they ask, what do we do now? And they mention that the leg is stuck, and they talk about how, they can just take her and leave the leg. And they say, like, no, the leg is the best part for eating. And then they make the joke that's, original recipe or extra crispy. And then they say in unison, original recipe it is. And that's cute. It's cute. It's a little bit, I don't know. It's cute. It's fair. It's fine. I didn't have any real problems with it. It just felt like, okay, these are the aliens that eat people. Let's call attention to that. And let's do that immediately after we introduce them. So then they start talking some more. And I did like the line where they said, let's be careful with our pronouns. And, so they refer to themselves as we. That feels like it's a pretty subtle, reference to kind of, the transgender community and trans lives and everything. At least it, intentional or not, that's where my mind went with it. So, trans and gender non-binary. Awesome. So, the Kennemits have a single shared mind, as I said before, and they're afraid of humans because humans have their own mind. And I love the way that one of them says, we are afraid of waking them up. Like, just the line read of that was a lot of fun.
Whatever we do, we don't want it to wake up.
We are afraid of them waking up.
Because they have their own mind.
And so, here's where I'll talk a little bit about this take on the Kennemit story. So, Kennemits, first of all, the idea of Kennemits as recurring villains in some kind of shared Twilight Zone universe is an intriguing concept. Like, I think of, like, I don't know, Klingons or an alien race like Q, I guess, from Star Trek or whatever. But, like, it would be interesting to see them take on that kind of recurring role, but that would never be the case, and I immediately regret saying that. But it's interesting to see how this episode, this version of the Kennemits, is kind of in contrast to Serve Man. So in To Serve Man, they were using diplomacy and the promise of, like, giving humanity, like, a perfect life in order to kind of trick humans into accepting them and, becoming food, essentially. So here we have the Kennemits are exploiting capitalism and using advertising to control people and with the promise of a good life, of a perfect life. So it's an interesting meld, or it's an interesting riff on that original premise from To Serve Man. And it's interesting because it is doing its own thing and saying its own, telling its own story with its own message and everything. So I thought that was pretty interesting to kind of compare and contrast them. So Janet wakes up and she yells at the aliens. And again, Gretchen Mol is just great. She has this kind of energy to her that it makes the tone of the episode feel so much less like this high octane, like, nervous energy, or the stakes are ridiculously high in the episode, as we find out. It is the extinction of humankind and everything. But through Janet's persona and Gretchen Mol's performance, this is downplayed so much. The severity of what's happening is downplayed so much because it is telling a story about Janet's experience and about her grief and her growth throughout the episode. And it's also very heightened. Everything is very, it's almost a comedic episode. And it's just, it's really well done. It's an interesting meld of so many different components that make this just really bizarre experience of watching this episode. And I just, I love it. I love this kind of capitalistic view of an alien invasion and the reaction to it from Janet. Like, she is so, like, she's great. She's fantastic. So she asks them, like, she gets their attention because she's not really that afraid of them. But she says the line, "Take me to your supervisor." And I love that. I was delighted by that. So they eventually do take her to that, and that's in part four. So part four of the episode is "Like the Great Glittering Cities of Your World," 2:49 p.m. And when they have the timestamp of 2:49 p.m., they have the Kanemet language on screen, which is pretty cool. So it's introduced to us that Janet is speaking to the Kanemet supervisor. She's on this giant screen, and the Kanemet race is watching her. And it reminded me a little bit of the depiction of the leader in Eye of the Beholder, just very, very vaguely. So she's kind of delivering this monologue. We eventually find out that she's talking to the kind of Kanemet queen. And she reveals that 2 years ago, she delivered a stillborn baby girl. And man, that's just so tragic. Like, that almost stops the episode in its tracks for me. Like, it's very dark. It's very just horrific. Like, the trauma of that is, unimaginable. And I found it interesting, though, that the Kanemets are learning about just true human despair and tragedy through Janet after they've built their entire knowledge of humanity based around advertising. I just think that that's an interesting juxtaposition. And she says the line, "I wish I didn't have the things I have." And that, I think, is the kind of pinpointing the confusion of the Kanemet when regarding them, thinking about Janet and viewing Janet. That is the kind of anomaly of it. That's her Neo the One moment. And so she asks where she is. And now is when it's revealed she's speaking directly to the Kanemet queen. And she reveals to Janet that they are afraid of how often you change your mind. And then, she kind of tells Janet that, you know, it's all of a hive mind thing and everything. And Janet says, "That doesn't sound very democratic." And to which the queen says, "In a democracy, half the population wants something different from what they're getting. We've seen how that can go." And, I thought that was great. Just kind of a good kind of back and forth between the two. But here's where we get one of the most genuinely hilarious moments of the entire episode and season of the entire show, like both seasons at this point, because, the Queen Kanemet goes through the history of humankind and so she says that, you know, they've been tracking humanity's radio frequencies and everything, for decades. And she recounts some of the stuff. She says, 1945, the United States defeats Japan. 1965, the Beatles defeat the son of your God. And that was just delightful. That was great. Obviously, it's a reference to, I think, was it John Lennon who said that they're bigger than Jesus, that the Beatles are bigger than Jesus? Or maybe Paul McCartney. I don't know which one said it. But anyway, I was cracking up with that. I thought that was just genuinely really funny. And so she talks about how they started watching, TV show broadcasts and everything. And another kind of funny, bit is that she says, "We studied studio applause because it was evidence of a single shared mind. And, imagine our disappointment when we found out that it was fake and canned like your Diet Cola." I thought, like, the dialogue here is just really good. And so Janet says, "You have all this unbelievable technology and all you've been doing is watching TV." And like, to that, I say, I can relate. That is me boiled down, in a one sentence one sentence line in a TV show. And the Kanemet Queen says, "Specifically, we have been watching your television commercials." And I love that Janet's response to this is like, "We don't even watch our commercials anymore." And she even says, "We've evolved. We skip past them." And just like, that is just, kind of good satire about the way we consume media and everything. Or I don't know if satire is the right word there, but it's just a great kind of commentary on that and the way that we've evolved as consumers of media. It's also really funny because I have paid for the CBS All Access subscription with no commercials. So that adds a little bit of funniness to that. Humor to that is the word I was looking for. And so the scene kind of shifts a little bit because the Candidate Queen says, it only matters that humans are stopped. And she goes on to say that they believe a human is most vulnerable when it perceives a lack of something. And all you ever did was want something you didn't already have. And so they're basically, she says that they can see her grief. They can see the grief of Janet. She says, like your great glittering cities, we can see your grief from space. And what I love about this is Janet says, my grief doesn't make television commercials. It's something private and it's not something that, can be co-opted to sell her products or control her, world. And if I can backtrack just a little bit, the Candidate Queen also said that, humans have evolved, but now, our commercials are in our minds. Like we're allowing subliminal messages and everything into our minds. So that's an interesting kind of viewpoint to take, I guess, or an interesting commentary to make about the way we consume media. So Janet says, you've been watching our commercials to see what makes us weak. And this is where she starts to figure it out. She figures out why, what they're doing and to what end. And she says, the egg, you know what it is. And the queen says, of course I do. Who do you think laid all of them? And this is where the episode goes just so deeper into crazy town. And I was all for it. Like I was very much invested at this moment. And something that kind of confused me a little bit was that the queen says, the idea wasn't ours, of course. The idea for the egg was yours, Mrs. Warren. So that everything could be okay again, and this time okay forever. And then she kind of reveals that she means everything will be okay because there won't be humans around to change their minds about it. But it's interesting that the idea wasn't ours, of course. The idea for the egg was yours. So that makes me wonder if she is this, like I said, anomaly of the human race, that they picked her to pick the one thing that would make all of humanity or everyone within their globe of influence, be able to connect with or be brainwashed into wanting. And it's this kind of stand-in product that would be replacement for a child, essentially, or something that would be like a child. And it also, it kind of plays into and kind of the whole aesthetic of the housewife and house kind of portions of the episode play into that kind of 50s nostalgia, like the nuclear family 50s nostalgia, kind of perfect picturesque family life. And it's an interesting riff on that. And I kind of wish we had more information about how this world is created or what this world entails and why it's so different from our reality and everything. But it doesn't detract from it too much. So then we get a shot of Ellen coming home with her egg and, we watch her wander around. And this is like such an amazing moment in the episode. So we watch her wander around. She's giddy with excitement. Another thing about the egg, the actual, packaging of it. So it's basically like a giant rock-like egg. That's wrapped, it reminds me of, the way it's wrapped, it reminds me of like a Christmas ham or a turkey or something. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I don't know if that's the intention, but it just kind of felt like that. Another kind of extension of like the kind of perfect family thing. Like, oh, we're going to have like, you know, a Christmas ham or something. I don't know. So this is where the episode just gets bonkers. We watch her wander around and everything, trying to find a place to put the egg. And then off screen, a creature hatches from it. And like it starts to hatch and she moves off screen with it. And like the sound effects are so great. Like there's growling and a hatching sound. And then like we hear Ellen say like, that's not nice. And then we hear screaming. And what I found so amazing and so refreshing and unique in this episode is that there's not just traditional blood splatter or anything. Instead, it's this blood mist that enters the frame, and it sets droplets onto the family portrait of Ellen and her family. And I just thought that that was so cool and so unique. And also, like, when the mist hits the portrait, it has this effect that's like, it's like rain hitting the portrait. And that's such a unique visual technique, because we're staring at it like it's like rain hitting it horizontally, like from left to right, instead of like up to down. Wait, is that right? Yeah. it's just a very bizarre kind of effect. And I really loved it for that. I really loved that. So we get what I think is the final kind of interlude commercial thing. And we see the little girl in the forest again. And I don't know if that's supposed to be young Janet or her memory of herself in the woods. It may be because she mentioned that she got lost in an amusement park. Maybe that's that version of her. But now the doll that she had is actually in the chest where the egg was in the earlier dream. And that kind of prepares us for Janet's decision. She's going to choose the egg because it represents her baby that died. That's the one thing she wants more than anything. And also, I think that maybe it's the Canemit that's finally getting her. Like, they're finally getting her because they've digested, no pun intended, the knowledge of how, what she's taking, like what makes her tick, what she is about. We cut back to her in the spaceship alone, and she calls for the Canemit. And I love this because she says, I wonder if you can tell me what time it is on Earth. And I love that because it's a callback to Serve Man. Like, the opening scene of To Serve Man has, what's his name? I can't remember the main character's, in a Canemit spaceship, and he says, like, hey, what time is it? And then they're like, time doesn't exist out here in space. And then he's like, well, what time is it on Earth? I love that. And it fits so well, because they've demonstrated that she has her fulfillment allotment at 4 p.m. So she needs to know when she needs to go. So then the Canemit, they explain that she won't be able to stop what's happening and that she'll be safe with them. And she says she doesn't care about that because she's made her decision. And I love this because she says, I just want to be at my designated fulfillment center at my allotted, I just want to be at my designated fulfillment center at my allotted fulfillment time, like a normal person. It's great because that's a, callback to Ellen's line early in the episode when Janet was trying to drag her into this conspiracy thing. And it also just kind of communicates to us that she's given up. Like, this is a dark ending for her. And I don't know what to make of it. The only way for her to escape grief is to accept the reality that humanity is gone. Like, humanity doesn't have a fighting chance. And in a way, it kind of reminds me of Jack's decision back in season one in A Traveler. He accepted this new regime and invaders, kind of trading one group of people who subjugated his people's lives and traditions for another. But here, Janet is making the choice to die with humanity in the hope that she will experience the thing that she's been missing from her life and that's left her broken for the last 2 years, if only for a moment. And that's a beautifully tragic sentiment, because she just wants to hold this egg as if it were her baby. And that's just so bleak for me. And it's kind of funny because the Canemits, they're like, well, you tried to cancel. And then she says, well, yeah, but that was before I knew what it was. And then I think that kind of confuses the Canemit, because the Canemit says, you understand it's a spawn designed to eradicate the human race. and she understands. And this is the most tragic part of it. She says, I just want to hold it even for a little while because it's mine. And man, that hits hard a bit. That's bleak. That's bleak. So then we're back at her house in her bedroom. She's back in, like, laying in bed, after being transported back. We hear sounds of chaos outside, and she looks in the empty crib and she says, and again, this is rough. She says, it would be much, much better if it was you coming home with me today. And like, although the episode itself has a high amount of wackiness and kind of a little bit lighthearted tone to it, this characterization is just so bleak and sad and tragic because, from my perspective, she kind of loses a little bit. Like, humanity loses, but she also loses because she's, I don't know, it's just, it's a weird, bleak ending for me. So she arrives at the fulfillment center and looks at her fulfillment card. Two things. One, 1015. I don't remember. I don't think 1015 was in the first two episodes. But having seen the 1015 on the card makes me think like, oh crap, I got to go back and watch the two episodes and look for 1015 anywhere I can if they're still doing that. But more importantly, it's the address on the card is 1015 Fremont Street, Major City, USA. And of course, Fremont Street is a reference to It's a Good Life, the character of Anthony Fremont, an episode that I haven't gotten to yet. But yeah, the date on the card, it's not of any importance, I don't think, but it's March 10th, 2021. I thought that was kind of interesting, I guess. So then the music that's playing here is, a song called Since I Don't Have You by the Skyliners. And as it's playing, she's walking against kind of chaos to get to the fulfillment center. And this lady runs by her with her egg and says, like, she's like, oh, Janet, I'm so glad you're here. Like, if anyone deserves an egg, it's you. And then she says, 9 out of 10 of us agree that you deserve an egg. And just, I don't know, just her words, like there was such a cool juxtaposition between her delirious energy with like her delirious happy energy and the just destruction and chaos that's surrounding her. Like that's, I don't know. I thought that was just a really, interesting juxtaposition in this kind of last scene of the episode. And so Janice starts running to get her egg. And then we see like the, we see the fulfillment center and the last shot is so cool. It's, the parking lot and then just flying saucers overhead. It's just very cool imagery. And then Jordan Peele, Jordan Peele wanders onto the scene and he gives what is just my favorite closing narration of all, probably, of the show, so far. Yeah, and here is his closing narration.
Existential dread got you down? Well, Mrs. Janet Warren finally found relief, albeit for a limited time only. But buyer beware, all sales are final. Here. In the Twilight Zone.
I love it. I love it so much. And I love how this closing narration, it's brief, but it's made up almost entirely of advertising cliches. I thought that was a very nice touch. And then I just think Jordan Peele's read of it is just so perfect. Like, there's something about it. It's like his narration has just, he's upped his game so much. It feels like he's so much more comfortable in the role of narrator and they are doing some really fun things with him. Like he's less of an ominous presence and like ominous. He was never doing a Serling impression. He was never trying to do like the Serling thing, but it feels like now he's doing a Peele thing. Like he's breaking out a little bit more and he's having some fun with it. I love it. I love it. Just something about his read of, existential dread got you down. Like something about it just feel like it's so good. I love it so much. This was a great closing narration. Yeah, well, I think that is my review of You Might Also Like. I don't have any notes or anything, that I didn't already cover in the episode or in the review. The only one I have is the address on Teacup Lane or Teacup Road, being a reference to I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House. So, yeah, that will do it for my review of You Might Also Like. Overall, I thought that this was a very good episode. There were some things that, didn't quite work for me, the way that I hoped that they would. But man, this was an out there episode, just super, just crazy. And I love the way that it paid tribute to Serve Man and to the, iconic creatures of the Canimates. Just really, really cool. Really cool episode that not only takes those characters and takes that idea or the threat from To Serve Man, and I don't want to say updates it, but creates a different context for it, with this iteration of it. And it's just, it's so much better than it would have been if they just remade To Serve Man, or if they made a sequel, like a direct sequel to Serve Man. This is the show kind of striking out on its own, doing its own thing while honoring the original series. And I don't know how people will react to it. I did see some comments that, I don't know, comments just kind of pissed me off. One comment I saw was that, today CBS kind of released pictures of the Candidates and everything and kind of announced like, oh, there's going to be a sequel to Serve Man in this season of The Twilight Zone. Kind of drum up interest and everything. I hope it works. I really hope that this gets a third season. I want this to go on for as long as it possibly can because I really love doing these reviews and I love watching the show. But one of the comments I saw was just some dude saying like, oh, I wonder how vulgar they're going to make this one. And like that just kind of made me laugh. Like I had my complaints about the profanity in the first season, but it didn't come from a place of like, oh, this needs to be clean or this series can't have profanity because I need to watch it with my kids. Because I don't have kids and I was fine with it. But like there were moments in season one where like, okay, they're just overdoing it with the vulgarity. Like, it's just, it's not constructive to the scene, or to the episodes. But what made me laugh was when I saw that comment about how, like, oh, I wonder how they're gonna make it so, how vulgar they're gonna make it. I thought of two things. One, I'm pretty sure that person's gonna hate the Eye Wide Shut VR intimacy goggles scene. And two is, Gretchen Mol's first line in the episode is "God damn it" when she wakes up, and I kind of just imagine that person having like a complete and total meltdown, like "Oh my god, they used God's name in vain." But I don't know. Anyway, not to discredit that or not to downplay people's complaints about the vulgarity or the profanity in the episodes, to each their own. It isn't a factor to me. And yeah, I honestly like this. These three episodes that I've watched feel like a big improvement. And I'll go ahead and end this episode on that note. So I'm recording this June 24th. The season proper is going to drop here in a few hours. Now I've recorded my reviews of these three episodes in a vacuum. Like, obviously I don't know how many people, like, I don't know what people are going to think of these episodes. So, based on these three episodes, in this vacuum that I'm in, I feel comfortable saying that this season of The Twilight Zone, if it continues this course that it's on through these three episodes, is on track to just be so much better than the first season. And I was a champion of the first season for the most part. Like, I liked the first season, but this is just a much more comfortable, and confident season of television so far. So I can't wait to watch the rest of it. Like, honestly, the reason why I recorded this tonight is because I am just dying to watch the next episode. And I will now have access to the rest of the episodes when they drop on CBS All Access. So I was fortunate enough to get these screeners, and I was super happy that CBS All Access, like, granted me that opportunity, but now I'm like itching for more. Like, I did not want to be in a situation where I had one more episode to review before I could watch the season that just popped up on my TV. So I'm so excited to watch the rest of the episodes. I am so bitter that I have to work tomorrow, but I have Friday off because it's my birthday, and that's going to be, that's just going to be Twilight Zone day for me. So, all this is a moot point because this episode is probably going up on July 2nd. So, let me know what you think of these episodes, these reviews. Let me know what you think of the show, of The Twilight Zone, the season and everything. Follow me on @OVAnthologyPod. And let's have a conversation about this show and this season because I'm really liking these three episodes and I can't wait to see what's next. So, that'll do it for this episode of Anthology, this bonus episode of Anthology. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. And now, here's a short clip from our Patreon-exclusive RSS feed. To hear the full clip and more exclusive Patreon content, go to patreon.com/obsessiveviewer and become a patron at the minimum rate of $1 per month. Thank you and enjoy. But, 317 episodes. That's totaling 21 days, 1 hour, 54 minutes worth of audio. Anthology, my solo podcast, launched August 3rd, 2015, so 2 years later and change. I've released 105 episodes for 4 days, 7 hours, 25 minutes worth of audio. And then Tower Junkies launched almost three years ago. Jesus! Almost 3 years ago, August 20th, 2017, and we have released 44 episodes for 2 days, 10 hours, 2 minutes worth of audio. That is a total of 466 podcast episodes spread across 3 podcasts, totaling 27 days, 19 hours, 22 minutes worth of audio. Tiny, why are you not sick of me yet?
Anthology is edited and produced by Matt Hurt and presented by ObsessiveViewer.com. For a full archive of our episodes, go to anthologypod.com/archive. You can also like the Facebook page at facebook.com/anthologypod and follow the show on Twitter at OVAnthologyPod. If you enjoy the show, please take a couple minutes to leave us a rating and a quick review on Apple Podcasts. This is the easiest way to support what we do, and all it costs is a little bit of your time. If you'd like to donate to the podcast, you can make a PayPal donation at anthologypod.com/donate or support us on Patreon for recurring donations and access to commentary tracks and B-roll audio recorded exclusively for patrons at patreon.com/obsessiveviewer. Every donation goes toward paying the fees to keep the podcast running and is greatly appreciated. Official Anthology merch, including shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more, can be found in the Obsessive Viewers TeePublic store. You can find a link to the store in the show notes of this episode and at anthologypod.com/donate. Or you can simply search for Obsessive Viewer at teepublic.com. For information about the Obsessive Viewers annual live event showcasing short horror films from local filmmakers, check out shocktoberinirvington.com. And for an archive of all our events, as well as news about potential future events, head over to obsessiveviewer.com/live. For more podcast content, you can find our flagship movie and TV review and discussion show, The Obsessive Viewer Podcast, at obsessiveviewer.com, and on Twitter at obsessiveviewer. You can also find Tower Junkies, a podcast where Matt and co-host Tiny share their love of all things Stephen King and his magnum opus, The Dark Tower series, over at TowerJunkiesPod.com and at TowerJunkiesPod on Twitter. And finally, check out The Secular Perspective, Tiny's side project podcast, which tackles current events and life's big questions from the perspective of secular hosts Chad and Amanda at TheSecularPerspective.com. Bumper music for this podcast comes courtesy of As Good As It Gets, which can be found at facebook.com/asgoodasitgetsband. You can also find As Good As It Gets music on Spotify, Google Play, and iTunes. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Kitty! Yeah.
Oh, for me, things are cool, but like for the world out there, outside of me.
Outside of you, sure.
Mrs. Warren, things are really definitely not, like, in the world, so definitely not okay, like, not at all, not at all. I mean, have you seen what all these human beings are doing?
Interesting. So you think it's something for the whole planet?
Don't you think it better be, Mrs. Warren?